Israel and Iran have traded direct blows in the past week. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, what to keep an eye on as that conflict evolves.
In a case like between Iran and Israel, the two countries that have no relationship with one another, there is plenty of space for misunderstanding before a new equilibrium is established.
And with historic elections underway in India, the name Modi still dominates the conversation.
Modi, first and last.
Plus, Chinese cities are sinking, and not just on the coasts.
And Canadian grocery shoppers are fed up with crazy high food prices.
I just went to the grocery store. First mistake.
So they're staging a grocery store boycott.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us this Friday. Over the next several weeks, nearly a billion voters will decide who controls India's lower house of parliament and, by extension, who will be the country's next prime minister.
Voting started today. Incumbent Narendra Modi is seeking re-election for a rare third consecutive term. I spoke earlier today with reporter Sushmita Pathak in Jaipur in northern India, where voters today cast the first ballots in a lengthy mega-election. So set the scene for us. I know you were out and about today in Jaipur. What did voting look like there today?
Well, it was very, very hot. It was the maximum, I think it was close to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. But in spite of that, I met a lot of people who were braving the heat and coming to cast their vote. I met a lot of people at schools. Schools are usually polling stations, voting centers, and all voting is electronic. You know, you go in, get your documents checked up, and then poll workers will also mark your forefinger with a special type of ink to make sure that no one votes more than once. And so that's what it looks like on the ground. And it all went pretty smoothly today for the most part.
People will be voting over the next several weeks. Why does it take so long?
It's because of logistics. The scale of the election is so enormous. You know, you have 970 million eligible voters, more than a million polling stations, which are spread across this vast and geographically diverse country. It's just much easier to manage if the voting is done in phases. Today was the first of seven phases, and the results will be out on June 4th. Splitting up the election also makes sense for security reasons. It gives security forces time to move from one place to another.
Modi and his party are dominating the conversation. Is there enthusiasm for other candidates and parties as well?
Well, I'll let voter Brijesh Kumar answer that for you.
Modi, first and last.
Modi, first and last, huh?
Yep. The main player is Modi's party, the BJP. They currently hold a majority in parliament, and they are favored to win this election. On the other side is a splintered opposition led by the Indian National Congress. Now, the Congress party for decades was the most dominant party in India. You know, former prime ministers Indira Gandhi and Rajiv Gandhi were from the Congress party. But since the BJP defeated the Congress in 2014 when Modi came to power, the Congress party has been really struggling. So frankly, there's not a lot of competition for Modi. Modi has one of the highest approval ratings in the world, and his party is expected to win this time too.
So in India's parliamentary system, I gather that most people who would like to see Modi back in power will not actually be voting for him directly, correct? They'll just be voting for their local representative from his party, the BJP?
That's right, except in the constituency of Varanasi, where Modi is contesting the election.
Got it. What exactly has Modi done over the past decade to make him so popular?
Well, I mean, Modi has amassed a cult-like following over the past decade. A lot of people gravitate towards him because of his strong persona. He's just very assertive. He's seen as very powerful. A lot of people resonate with his humble beginnings. You know, he often repeats the story of how he was a chaiwala, a tea seller, when he was young, and now he's risen to the highest office in India. Coming to what he's done in the past decade, his policies, I asked Vikas Sharma about this. He runs a small cable TV business in Jaipur, and I met him just after he'd voted. He credits Modi for providing welfare benefits to the poor, you know, food, grains, free gas cylinders, free medicine. and for bringing down corruption. He also credits Modi for infrastructure development. Look at the roads, he said. And he also praised Modi for elevating India's position on the world stage.
Desh aage bade, isse jyada important kuch bhi nahi hai. Aur uske liye sirf ek hi naam hai, Modi.
He said Modi is the only person equipped to take India forward.
Modi is particularly popular among Hindus in India. Why is that?
Over the past decade, we've seen a rise in Hindu nationalism, and Modi's party really is the face of Hindu nationalist politics. You know, Modi and his party take a lot of pride in being Hindu. Hinduism is India's majority religion, and India is increasingly becoming a Hindu-first nation, a lot of critics say. It's moving away from secularism. And at the same time, human rights groups have noted that minorities in India, especially Muslims, have increasingly come under attack. Many of the Modi government's policies are also seen as anti-Muslim. The BJP denies any accusation of discrimination, though. And to be fair, Hindu-Muslim tensions have existed in India long before Modi came to power. But critics say that under him, those tensions have gotten worse. This came up when I spoke to Muslim voters like Asif Mohammed. He brought his baby to the polling station and he told me he wants his kids to grow up in an India where no one has to live in fear.
So what are Modi's weaknesses? What is counting against him in this upcoming election?
You know, unemployment is a big weakness of this government. Despite steady economic growth, India hasn't been able to create enough jobs for its growing population, particularly for young people. And unemployment did come up when I spoke to voters today. Even those who support Modi want him to do better on this front. Critics also say that under Modi, India's democratic institutions have suffered. There is less freedom of expression and more media censorship. So those are some, criticisms that the Modi government often faces.
Sushmita Pathak is in the city of Jaipur covering the Indian elections, which began today.
In China, nearly half of the country's major cities are measurably sinking, according to a new study. Some of them are sinking as much as a third of an inch per year.
That might not sound like a lot, but it's enough to intensify the likelihood of infrastructure damage and severe flooding, especially as sea levels rise.
This is all according to a new analysis of satellite data published this week in the journal Science. A variety of factors are causing urban land to sink, including pumping water out of the ground and the weight of heavy buildings.
This is a global issue that could impact as many as 1 in 5 people around the world, according to one estimate. That includes the East Coast of the United States. There is a solution, though. Limit how much water can be pumped out of the ground. According to researchers, that's helped keep the Japanese cities of Tokyo and Osaka from caving in. Research suggests it may be helping in Shanghai as well.
Israel carried out an attack on Iran late last night near the city of Isfahan, Iran's second largest metropolitan area. The operation was confirmed by senior U.S. and Iranian officials. It appears to be Israel's response to Iran's attack on Sunday when Tehran fired hundreds of drones and missiles at Israel. U.S. officials have urged restraint and de-escalation, and today Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. was not involved in the attack.
We're committed to Israel's security. We're also committed to de-escalating, to trying to bring this tension to a close.
For details, let's turn to Ali Vaez. He's the Iran Project Director for the International Crisis Group, and he joins us from Washington. Ali, what do we know so far about the weapons Israel used in this attack against Iran?
There are still more questions than answers about what exactly happened, but it appears that Israel fired 3 ballistic missiles into Iran from the Iraqi airspace. There were also some small drones that Iranians shot down. And so it's quite possible that this was a hybrid attack, that there were drones that were flown from inside the country in order to confuse or distract the aerial defense systems so that the missiles could actually reach their targets.
Now, since Iran's attack on Israel last weekend, it was unprecedented, the U.S. has been urging Israel to use restraint. Do you think the scale of this retaliatory attack by Israel on Iran is an indication that Israel is listening or not listening?
Well, I think President Biden's preference would have been that Israel would not respond at all. But now that Israel has responded, we can say safely that it was a very limited and restrained response. And that hopefully would result in both sides being able to draw a line under this chapter and move on. The reality is that with what Israel has done, it basically has signaled to Iran that it does not allow Iran to unilaterally revise the rules of the game, but also it has not triggered a broader escalation and putting Iran in a position that it feels that the urge to retaliate in kind is irresistible.
Tell us more about Isfahan, which was the nearest city to where the attack took place, and its strategic role in Iran.
Well, Isfahan is at the heart of the country, and this is the message that Israel was trying to send, that it can reach deep inside Iran. But Isfahan is also the ancient capital of Persian Empire, the Safavid Empire. There are a lot of UNESCO-protected heritage sites in that city, but it is also the location of Iran's drone production factory and also some of Iran's most important nuclear facilities. And in the past, Israel has conducted covert operations against those facilities. And that's why what Israeli counterstrike seems to fall in the category of covert operations, which is the status quo of the relationship between the two countries, the gray zone combat that they've been fighting for many years now.
Given the proximity of the attack to Iran's nuclear sites, do we know anything about how close Iran is to acquiring a nuclear weapon?
Well, Iran has never been closer to the threshold of nuclear weapons. When President Trump withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran, it would take Iran about 12 months to enrich enough uranium for a single nuclear weapon. It would still have to fashion that into a nuclear device. But today we are in a situation that it would only take Iran about 6 days to enrich enough uranium for a single nuclear weapon. And for the first time since the beginning of the nuclear crisis with Iran, Iran has the possibility, given the lower level of inspections of its nuclear program by UN inspectors, to basically dash towards weaponized uranium without detection.
Did these attacks by Israel, did they damage anything? Did they damage any nuclear sites or cause any casualties?
So nuclear sites, we know that they have not been damaged because last night the U.S. administration had leaked to the media that nuclear sites were not among the targets. And this morning, the head of International Atomic Energy Agency, the U.N. nuclear watchdog, has announced that the nuclear sites are intact. And so it appears that at least the nuclear sites were not the main target, but the signaling is hard to miss, that Israel was trying to tell Iran that its nuclear program is also within Israel's reach.
But do we know of any casualties from these attacks by Israel?
There has been no announcement, and the Iranians, I think, are purposefully minimizing the attack because it gives them a face-saving way out of the cycle of escalation. The main question to which we don't have an answer is whether this was a one-off Israeli attack or is a prelude to more attacks or bigger attacks in the future.
Which leads me to my last question. Where do you think things stand now between Israel and Iran?
Look, I think in this process, both sides have demonstrated that neither has the appetite for a direct confrontation or for the expansion of the conflict in Gaza. But the most dangerous moment in any geostrategic rivalry is when the parties start revising the rules of the game. Because in a case like between Iran and Israel, the two countries that have no relationship with one another, there is plenty of space for misunderstanding before a new equilibrium is established. And so in the coming weeks and months, we might see that as the conflict in Gaza continues, and there's currently no light at the end of the tunnel for that war, that there is still plenty of risk for Iran and Israel, even if this episode has come to an end, to commit miscalculations and for tensions to spiral out of control.
Ali Vaez is the International Crisis Group's Iran Project Director. He joined us from Washington. Still ahead, a traditional beach drink in Turkey makes a comeback. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Canadians are mad about the high cost of food. So mad, in fact, that fed-up shoppers say they are not going to take it anymore. They're calling for a boycott of the country's largest supermarket chain, which happens to be owned by Canada's wealthiest man. Anita Elash brings us the story from Toronto.
Over the last few weeks, social media has exploded with anti-Loblaws music.
Whoa!
Loblaws hates you, Loblaws hates you, ain't the place to shop at.
Anti-Loblaws memes.
I just went to the grocery store. First mistake.
And anti-Loblaws rants.
I just paid like $80 for 2 days worth of food. How are we supposed to survive?
The online community Loblaws is Out of Control now has more than 50,000 members. They plan to boycott Loblaws until it cuts prices by 15% and eliminates special offers reserved for members of the store's loyalty program. Emily Johnson started the community late last year.
To raise prices beyond the rate of inflation and to continue to add to the cost of living crisis that Canadians are facing today is not okay.
Johnson told Global Television News she set up the group after noticing Loblaws was selling a small Christmas arrangement for $62.
It was a ridiculously priced ribbon and sticks.
Johnson said thousands of people joined after Loblaws eliminated its deep discounts on food that's nearly expired. More people joined when one of Canada's biggest insurance companies made an exclusive deal with Loblaws' chain of pharmacies. Neither decision stuck, but Johnson says consumers are still angry.
A lot of people are saying, you know what, I don't actually have another option than a Loblaws store. And so they really just, they want something to change.
Loblaws accounts for 30% of grocery sales in Canada. It also offers banking, has a sophisticated customer loyalty program, and has its own popular in-house brand. Food economist Sylvain Charlebois says all that definitely puts Loblaws in the driver's seat.
They have too much power, and that's really hurting consumers.
But he says there's no evidence Loblaws is gouging consumers. What it does do is pressure suppliers into paying for the right to be sold there.
They're actually gouging suppliers, which leads to more price volatility that impacts consumers. So if I were to really make a boycott worthwhile, I would probably create a lobby group to lobby against all grocers.
Loblaws says it's doing everything it can to lower prices, including building more discount stores and offering reductions on some basic household items. A Canadian parliamentary committee is looking into a national grocery store code of conduct. Charlebois says that would even the playing field and help keep prices down. Meanwhile, some shoppers at this Loblaws discount subsidiary in Toronto's West End say they doubt a boycott will do much good. Brendan Everenden is here buying juice boxes for his three-year-old son.
Here, Henry. It's orange juice. Delish. It was on sale.
He says his food budget has doubled since the pandemic, mostly because of inflation.
So you're going to boycott Loblaws. The other stores aren't much better. So why not boycott everything?
Everenden says, like many Canadians, he's trying to shop more at some local independent grocers. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
Spring is just getting started at the World Headquarters in Boston. It's still coat weather here. But in Turkey, it's almost beach season. And for lots of people there, no trip to the coast is complete without a cold, bubbly drink called gazoz, a soda that gets its flavors from the towns where it's made. The World's Duri Buscarin reports from Urla in southern Turkey.
Ferhat İskit's cafe serves up plenty of coffee and tea, but what people really come for is the gazoz. We started with 3 or 5 flavors, and now we've found 130, İskit says, as he shows his collection, proudly displayed along a wall for customers to browse.
Bunlar yurdumuzda olan yöresel gazozlar bunlar.
These are the local sodas of our country, İskit says. Every province has its own gazoz. İskit's favorites are all from small town microproducers. One from the kite-surfing coast of Alaçatı is flavored with mastic gum, an aromatic tree resin. There's an almond gazoz from the Datça Peninsula, famed for its almond orchards, and a hot pink lavender peach flavor that pops right off the shelf. It's made in Denizli, a town which grows both lavender and peaches, near the ruins of an ancient Roman city.
Bu da mükemmel bir gazoz.
That is an excellent gazoz, İskit says. Iskit Gezel's collection has become a destination for Urla vacationers, brimming with memories of a soda whose heyday was over 50 years ago. We might lose it someday, but now it's nostalgic. It's a beautiful thing, and it tastes good, says 77-year-old Ahmet Soylemez. He prefers the classic caramel taste of Mercan Gazoz, a brand from his hometown of Izmir that has been around since his childhood. Gazoz was first manufactured at the beginning of the 20th century by a Greek-Ottoman businessman fresh off a trip from France. The French phrase for carbonated water, l'eau gazeuse, hit the Turkish markets as gazoz and made a splash. Then our locals made it, Söylemez says. Gesturing towards the wall of gazoz, he says, here we can see every corner of Turkey. Villages, big cities, all different people have taken the formula and produced it. Gazoz spread throughout the countries of the former Ottoman Empire. In this song by Egyptian singer Leyla Nazmi, she insists that she doesn't drink tea, only gazoz. As the Ottoman Empire broke apart and people migrated, the popularity of gazoz only grew.
This is also a period of big migrations, and Turkey has always been a land of migrations.
Zafer Yanal, a food sociologist at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, says this blossoming of gazoz brands continued in the middle of the 20th century as people moved from small towns and villages to big cities. The taste of their hometown gazoz became a point of pride and one that wasn't too expensive to pick up at a local store.
The first question that people would ask to each other, where do you come from? Right, memleket neresi? This is also kind of an indication how strong and how important local and regional identities are.
And gazoz connected people to that sense of identity. In the 1980s, multinational brands like Coca-Cola and Pepsi became too much for local gazoz producers to compete with. One by one, they went out of business. But in the past 5 years or so, Turkey has started to see a revival of small gazoz makers experimenting with old flavors. Yanal sees their popularity as a response to globalization.
It's a very fleeting world. These kinds of local products might help them to feel a bit more at home, to feel more secure.
And with that, summer is served. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin, Urla, Southern Turkey.
More stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World.
The U.S. is deporting people to Haiti again.
There's opposition to deportation as foreign nationals are still being evacuated by helicopter from Haiti right now.
And musicians want to pay for nature sounds.
Sounds like seagulls and waves and wind. Why don't we pay nature a royalty for that?
Ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. The House of Representatives is expected to vote this weekend on an aid package that could send billions of dollars to Ukraine. Officials in Washington and Kyiv have been warning that Ukraine is being outgunned by Russia and that without significant U.S. support, it could lose to the Kremlin.
Neither side in this war is releasing death toll figures, but on the ground, the human costs are enormous. Our next story is about a Ukrainian man who is all too familiar with those costs. He leads a group of volunteer body collectors in a deeply personal quest to lay the military dead to rest. From the Associated Press and Reveal, Michael Montgomery reports.
It's nighttime, and reporters for the Associated Press, including Solomia Hera, are tearing across the Ukrainian countryside. They're chasing a mud-covered SUV with Red Cross emblems on its doors.
On the top of the car, there were black bags, which we immediately recognized it was Yukov and his buddies.
Yukov is Oleksiy Yukov.
So we started driving after him, but he was driving very rigidly and speeding up. It was the middle of the night. He was certainly in a rush to unload his bodies and probably go back home to rest.
From behind, Solomia can see body bags bouncing on the roof of Yukov's SUV. Inside, there are more bodies. Eventually, Yukov steers off the road and into a clearing. He parks next to a white refrigerated truck marked with a red cross and the number 200. That's military code for vehicles carrying the dead. Under the glare of headlights, men in flak jackets and helmets carefully lower the heavy bags down from the roof. There are a dozen bodies in all. The bodies are then loaded onto the refrigerated truck, which will ferry them to a morgue. Yukov and his team will be back in the field tomorrow. They're civilians who combed through battlefields and bombed out buildings to gather the remains of Ukrainian and Russian fighters. They call their volunteer group Plotstarm, or Bridgehead. Their mission is to help the souls of the dead find rest. It's grisly, dangerous work, work that Yukov has become reluctant to talk about with the press because he feels that most reporters only seem interested in the gruesome side of his work. Solomia assured him that's not the plan.
So it took us around 6-7 months to set up interviews, and we were still not sure if he would arrive to that interview.
This is video footage from a camera that Yukov has strapped to his helmet. He and his colleagues are treading cautiously through the blasted ruins of a farmstead.
Well, friends, this is the second day of the search for our dead soldiers here in this area. This is the village of Dovhenke, Kharkiv region, and this is the exact location of the soldier who died.
Yukov is very determined to find a missing body if one asks him so. And one time he was contacted by a family of a missing person, and that family knew the place of where a soldier died, Ukrainian soldier died, and they asked Yukov and his team to go on site and try to bring the body back home.
And now our group is going to the location. We have confirmed that the soldier's body could be in the cellar.
Yukov has been texting with the mother of the missing Ukrainian soldier. His name is Oleksandr Khresuk, Sasha to friends and family. The team works its way past shredded trees, a mangled tractor, empty artillery crates, and heaps of rubble. Any wrong step could trigger an anti-personnel mine or a buried mortar round. In fact, just a few weeks earlier, Yukov tripped a mine here. He lost an eye in the blast. Now he's back again, searching for Sasha.
He was brought by his fellow soldiers to the cellar. The cellar has collapsed, and the body is lying there under the rubble. So we will now excavate and look for the guy.
A slab of concrete is blocking the way in, so a team member stabs at it with a big iron rod.
We are breaking the slab now. We will haul it out and dig further, because there is already some smell. There may be a body in there.
Yukov climbs down into the darkness. His headlamp flashes left and right, but he can't locate the body. All he can see is rubble and dirt. Just then, a gray tabby kitten comes from nowhere. It jumps on Yukov's shoulder and rubs against his cheek.
A kitten came up to us, and he's been hanging around this cellar. What a handsome cat. You came to us, yes, just like the souls who come by and wander next to us.
The kitten kept jumping on his shoulder and jumping to the one specific place. And Alexei thought, okay, let's try to dig where the cat jumps. And they take their tools, they dig in, and they find the Ukrainian soldier he's been looking for. So in that way, he felt that the kitten was a soul of that soldier's, a soul who came to point his location.
The team has been searching for Sasha for weeks, with his mother anxiously awaiting the news. And now they've found what they think are his remains. Yukov sends the family a photo of a silver cross and chain they recovered in the basement. Sasha's mother recognizes it instantly. She texts Yukov and thanks him and says his work is priceless. It's an island of gratitude in a sea of sorrow.
I understand that we took away the last hope from her, a mother's hope, to have her child come home, home alive.
Yukov's phone buzzes all the time. Desperate relatives of fallen Ukrainian soldiers implore him to look for their sons, husbands, and brothers. Military units typically carry away their dead, but in the chaos of combat, it's not always possible. So there's a seemingly endless supply of work for Yukov's team.
The body is partially burned. The helmet is on the head. The left lower leg is partially missing.
They document each location and set of remains carefully. The bodies of Ukrainian soldiers are often returned to their families for burial. The bodies of Russian fighters are sometimes traded with the enemy for those of fallen Ukrainians. Yukov reckons his team has collected the remains of 1,000 people since 2022. They post videos of their work on social media. Yukov wants to show fellow Ukrainians that their heroes are being cared for. And he also uses the videos to speak directly to Russian audiences in Russian to show them what this war is costing.
What is it all for? Is it because one person has gone mad and decided that he could rule the whole world and destroy everyone who opposes him? Well, this is madness.
Oleksiy Yukov's dedication to the dead didn't start here. It goes back to his childhood and back to tragedies that devastated this part of Eastern Europe. In the early 1930s, the brutal policies of Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin triggered widespread famine. Around 4 million Ukrainians starved to death. Then came World War II. Ukraine was a vast combat zone, the Red Army against the forces of Nazi Germany. In the desperate fighting, both sides often buried their dead in mass graves, if they had time for burials at all. More than half a century later, Yukov rode his bicycle to a nearby forest, the site of a big battle. He was just a kid. The ground around him was strewn with the wreckage of war.
I began to figure out these were Soviet-style boots, not German. And Soviet belts, and Soviet bullets. I realized that these were Soviet soldiers. There were hundreds of them. The whole forest was covered with bones. I started to collect them and put them in one place, and I wondered, how could they be forgotten? It's someone's grandfather, someone's grandmother. So I started collecting the bones. And this was my first encounter with war.
From this time on, Yukov says he felt an intense connection with the dead. He says as a boy, he used to dream about them at night. He sensed their spirits and felt a duty to help their souls find peace.
He said, these are humans, and probably families of these dead bodies don't even know where their relatives are.
Solomia says that according to Ukrainian Orthodox tradition, a dead person's soul lingers among the living for 40 days.
But for a soul to be free and to be able to be calm, one needs to be buried properly with all the rituals and maybe prayers. So funerals is a very important part of Christian tradition. And there is no way a person is not buried, because then the soul cannot find peace.
Yukov found his life calling, bringing peace to forgotten bones in the forest. Before Russia's invasion, he led a group of volunteers exploring the Ukrainian countryside for the unclaimed dead of World War II. Yukov figures he's helped gather the bones of more than 8,000 souls. Another day, another battlefield. This time, Yukov and his team are recovering the remains of a Russian soldier. The body is at the bottom of a staircase in a bombed-out building. Russian forces sometimes booby-trap the bodies of fallen fighters. So one of the team members ties a long, sturdy strap around the ankle of the corpse. From a safe distance, Yukov counts to three.
Раз, два, три. Тягнемо! Почали!
Then they haul in the strap, moving the body just a few feet. That's all it takes. Once they've done this, they know it's safe to move by hand. Since the beginning of the war, Yukov has only lost one man, a volunteer named Denis, who drove a car over an anti-tank mine. Before the war, Denis was one of Yukov's kickboxing students. Another of Yukov's students is 27-year-old Artur Simeko. Artur was 14 when he first met Yukov.
Getting to know him changed everything. He's become a father, a friend, a brother to me.
Before Russia's invasion, Artur helped Yukov search for the dead in the old World War II battlefields. When this new war came, Artur was ready again.
Everything I know comes from Alexei about how to treat the dead. I learned about what happens if you treat the dead badly. You will get it back fast. When the war with Russia started, I was very calm towards the bodies of Russian soldiers. One should respect death.
Being calm and respectful toward the remains of Russian soldiers is something that Solomia says can challenge widespread perceptions in Ukraine.
War breeds collective hatred. So for many Ukrainians, it can be hard to see a dead Russian soldier as a human being.
But Yukov teaches that once Russian soldiers have fallen, they belong to the world of the dead, and they deserve a measure of dignity and honor.
There is a lot to learn from Yukov's philosophy of respecting the dead. He says, please respect also the bodies of Russian soldiers.
Late one night, Yukov and his team unload the bodies they've collected from a combat zone near Bakhmut. He searches the pockets for identifying information. The bodies are in bad shape, but on one soldier, Yukov finds a neck chain with a kind of dog tag.
Here's an identifying sign, it's an ID badge, and an Orthodox cross. The badge is made of aluminum. It's in poor condition, so it's hard to see. I'll try to clean it up a little. This is a Russian serviceman. How long have you been lying there? 3 months, maybe?
Yukov takes detailed notes, making sure any possessions he finds on the Russian body stay with it.
It is also important for him to bring not only the body, but the personal belongings of the body to their family, because for families, it's also something very sacred and important. For example, if one is religious and they have a cross, it's important for the family to have this cross of their son with them after. So he is taking care of every small detail or personal thing.
With the AP's camera rolling, Yukov grows angry about the scene before him, a line of 11 dead Russian soldiers and the leg of another, probably a Ukrainian soldier. In World War II, many Russians and Ukrainians came together to fight the Nazis.
And now, since 2014, we're collecting bodies again. And we see the horrors of war again. War has one face, what you see here. It's stupidity and death. And no matter what they call it, a special military operation or whatever, it doesn't change the essence. War has one face, death and stupidity and horror. And we don't need this war. Why did they come to us with this war?
Yukov looks down at the men laid out on the night grass. Suddenly, he switches from speaking in Ukrainian to Russian. He has a message for the parents of dead Russian soldiers.
I will tell them in Russian. Why did you raise your children? For a bright future or for death? You're crazy. You carried this child in your womb.
Do you remember how happy you were with every first step of his? How happy you were with every new word that your child said? And now your Russian boys are lying here, in Ukrainian soil. Why did you let them come here? You knew what this was all about, that they were going to kill.
It's late. Yukov and his exhausted team prepare the bodies for transport to a morgue. The Russian soldiers will likely be bartered for the remains of Ukrainian soldiers. And as always, Yukov and his colleagues treat the enemy with respect. "We are not fighting the dead," he says. "Our weapon is humanity and a shovel."
That was Michael Montgomery with Reveal, along with reporter Solomia Hera. This story was produced by Stephen Smith, with original reporting from Erica Kienetz of the Associated Press. We've got a link to the full Reveal episode at our website, theworld.org. You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The UN has warned the world that Haiti has reached the brink of collapse. A transitional council has been created with the goal of stabilizing the country, but heavily armed gangs still control much of Haiti, and Port-au-Prince remains unsafe. Against that backdrop, the Biden administration has resumed deportation of Haitians who have run afoul of U.S. immigration law. Harold Isaac is an independent reporter based in Haiti, and he's following all of this. Harold, we'll get to the deportation issue in a moment, but what exactly is this transitional council for Haiti?
Well, it's an experiment that the country is about to make, and it has turned official in the last week. And now this seven-member presidential council has to be installed in the coming hours or days, somewhere this weekend or the next week.
So what is its mandate and who's serving on it?
Well, let's put it this way. President Ariel Henry was the de facto head of state. But if you went into any state offices, Jovenel Moïse's portrait is still hanging on the wall in certain state offices. And this goes to show you how much of a political void there's been in the executive branch for that long. And in the meantime, you know, the constitutional clock was still ticking and you don't have a parliament and the judicial branch is dysfunctional. So you really have a situation where people were like, OK, anything that happens, something needs to happen. After Premier Henri was, let's say, prevented from coming back into the country, it kind of propelled us from a de facto government to a ghost government. So now Haitians just need whatever they can get their hands on, which is a government that will primarily have the mandate to restore security and deliver on elections. And that is a really big if. Perhaps the best way to describe it is some sort of national union government, a collective that will be in charge of delivering security and elections in the coming 2 years. Its term is set to expire on February 7th of 2026.
So is the idea that it's kind of an interim government, or is it a committee that's come together to figure out a path forward?
It's to be determined. And the reason is tensions within the Haitian society are essentially manifesting within the establishment of this committee. On one hand, you have those who are arguing that it should be an opportunity to change the constitution. And then the other, you have those who argue that essentially Haiti should try and return to the constitutional order.
And who is serving on this transitional council?
So you have about seven various sectors, plus an additional two. It includes political parties you could consider as traditional parties in the country established, such as Lavalas. You have members of the civil society, such as the Montana Accord Group, who some people will label as an opposition group. You have even members or the accord that was backing the former government that is also included in that coalition.
Now, the U.S. has just resumed deportations of Haitians. What kind of daily life are they returning to?
Well, it's complicated for them. Normally, deportations are done over Port-au-Prince. However, in this specific case, the only operating international airport in Haiti right now is 250 kilometers up north in Cape Haitien. And that's where the U.S. has started their deportation. And if these folks, I'd say, were coming from the metropolitan area of Port-au-Prince, getting back into the city will be very complicated.
Now, Harold, I'm wondering about you. How are you able to even report? You're based in Port-au-Prince. Isn't the situation there dangerous?
It is. It is absolutely dangerous, and it is a challenge to be reporting day to day. But what I could say is that it is a reality for anybody, you know, that is living here and that has to figure it out. You know, for those who have the option to leave, it almost became a duty to stay and to figure it out with you know, friends and families that we have here. So folks you talk to, you know, on the streets and offices, people you're meeting, you know, at the market, at the supermarket, what they're telling you is that it is a duty for them to stay. Where would they go? You know, what is expecting them anywhere else? You know, and this is what is leading a lot of folks to stay despite it all. But it is our reality, and I wouldn't change it for anything else.
Harold Isaac is an independent reporter based in Haiti. He joined us from Port-au-Prince.
One final note before we go. Actually, a whole bunch of notes from musicians helping to fund conservation through a Spotify playlist. Don't
you
worry
about the future. UK pop icon Ellie Goulding is one of 15 performers making music with sounds from nature. The Spotify playlist is called Feat Nature, as in featuring nature, giving credit where it has long been due.
On this track, nature provides the sounds of a tropical forest. Each time this song and others from the same playlist are played, a percentage goes to environmental groups.
This David Bowie song was remixed by the famous producer Brian Eno, especially for the project.
Look, we all use the sounds of nature a lot in what we do. Sounds like seagulls and waves and wind, and why don't we pay nature a royalty for that? And then redirect that money towards people who are helping save the world.
The project launched on Spotify this week in advance of Earth Day, April 22nd. A panel of environmental activists, scientists, conservation experts, and representatives of indigenous peoples will decide where the money goes.
Artists include India's Anuv Jain, Norway's Aurora, and Colombia's Bamba Estéreo. Brian Eno says it's time the music business understood the importance and value of the natural world.
What I think music can do is to give you feelings. And if you can say to people, can you imagine a better world? Here's what it would sound like. That gives people a set of feelings about how life could be, how else things could be.
Spotify will donate 50% of the streaming royalties from the playlist, and it will give an even bigger share when people click on Spotify's ambient nature tracks, such as this sound of tropical rain from Colombia.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here on Monday.